There's a disturbing new trend among Afghanistan's rural women. They're setting themselves on fire.
It's a real indication of quite how bad things are for women that this becomes their only choice in their eyes.
Plus, signs you might be suffering from lifestyle creep. And our correspondent in Italy catches up with one of America's best-known activist actors. I'm Susan Barnett, and you're listening to 51%, The Women's Perspective. Attempted suicide can be the ultimate act of desperation. And in rural Afghanistan, there's a growing epidemic of women setting themselves on fire in an effort to escape lives they find unbearable. Rachel Reed is a researcher for Human Rights Watch. She has been monitoring the situation, and Human Rights Watch is working with the Afghan government to try to create policies that offer women hope for the future.
In Afghanistan, there is a very severe problem with self-immolation among women, particularly in certain areas of the country. In the west of the country, it's a very serious problem, although it happens all over the country. And it's a real indication of quite how bad things are for women that this becomes their only choice in their eyes, you know. And it speaks to the lack of places for them to turn to when they've got problems. Many of the women who kill themselves in this awful way are victims of domestic violence, or they're young girls being forced into marriage. Forced marriage and child marriage is a very serious problem in Afghanistan. Violence against women is endemic, really. And there's very little space for them to turn to the authorities. There's a view in society that if you've got problems at home, you keep them in the home. And for women or girls to go to the police service, for instance, they're often treated as bad women and sent back home, or indeed may receive abuse at the hands of the police. So it's a real sign of the lack of places for women to turn to. There have been real efforts, actually, by the... There are some very active women's rights... Afghan women's rights activists, and they've pushed hard to create shelters in Afghanistan, which is a new thing since the fall of the Taliban. But there's really only, there are still very few of those, and certainly not enough to deal with the huge numbers of women and girls who are facing these kinds of problems.
Do you have a sense of the number of women who have either successfully or attempted to kill themselves by fire?
Honestly, I'm not sure what the numbers are this year, but we're talking hundreds, and I'm not sure that we really have a very clear picture of how often this happens either. If you go into the very rural areas of Afghanistan, it's still a very rural country, and a lot of things get covered up there. You know, I think it's also possible that sometimes women are murdered and it's made to look like self-immolation. I'd tell you one encouraging thing, actually. Although this maybe the fact that I find this encouraging will give you an indication of how bad things are. But the Minister of Public Health actually spoke about this recently and talked about how this was an escalating problem, and talked about recognised that there was a very serious problem with mental health problems, and that also there was a very serious problem with rape and domestic violence. And actually, for a minister to raise these kinds of issues, it's still new. I mean, these are still areas that that women have been pushing, but it's still not part of the normal discourse in society that rape exists. I mean, actually, rape was made a crime in Afghanistan for the first time only last summer.
And one of the things I found interesting in the article was understanding why women would choose fire. It's the only thing that's available to them.
Yeah, again, I'm taking you back to these very rural areas where women are often in very conservative areas where they don't have much freedom of movement. Often women are not really expected to be in public life. In Taliban-controlled areas, they are restricted from being in public life, as they were when the Taliban were in power, but in non-Taliban areas as well, and in areas like the west of the country, Herat, where this is very common, or more common, it's still a deeply conservative part of society. Women are very covered, and they don't have much interaction, much access to to other means. But no, it's a terrible picture. Afghanistan is one of the few countries in the world, possibly the only country in the world, where more women than men try to kill themselves.
Rachel, what happens to the women, and apparently there are a fair number of them, who don't die but are horribly, horribly hurt and then are sent home? Do you have any sense of what happens to them?
I mean, I've been to wards where women who've tried to kill themselves through this way are treated, and actually many of the women will die terribly painful, awful deaths when they get to these hospitals. The majority of women admitted to burns units who've tried to kill themselves in this way won't survive because of the severity of their injuries. There was a very interesting study done about some of the women who are, you know, what then happens to the women, particularly those who have been there trying to flee domestic violence. And in cases where these were married women trying to escape an unhappy marital home, which is the majority of cases, out of 100 cases, only two of those cases did their birth parents take them home. Often it's still seen by a girl's mother and father that, you know, she has to suffer. She can't bring shame upon the family by leaving her husband. Divorce is still extremely rare here. So even in these cases where a woman has got so desperate that she's tried to kill herself by setting herself on fire, she's still largely expected by her own family, by her community, expected to return to the place that was causing her so much distress.
And can you help people understand? I mean, we live in a Western society where there are probably people whose first reaction when they hear that a woman is being abused or is miserably unhappy is, why don't you turn around and attack your attacker instead of trying to kill yourself? And they need to understand the culture of that place and why that's so unlikely.
There was a study done that asked respondents when they think it would be okay for a woman to go to the police when she's suffering domestic violence. And only 15% of the people that they asked thought that when a woman is beaten so badly she's disabled by her injuries, only then is it okay for her to go to the police. Only 15% thought it would be okay for a woman disabled by violence to go to the police. This is just not a culture where... I mean, it's not a culture where men complain very often either, but particularly women, they are just not expected to challenge the men around them. In urban areas with the small and growing middle-class women, that's not so much the case, and you see very brave women who are pushing the boundaries of these cultural barriers and are trying to win a divorce, or, you know, trying to challenge the way in which they're being treated. But really, it's partly also that these communities don't necessarily see individuals. It's much less individualistic society. So if you are having problems, you're still seen as a member of a family unit. And there is family honor at stake. So for one family, it would effectively mean one family challenging the honor of another family. And that, in a culture where you still have blood feuds very often, is a really significant thing. But I think actually underlying it is really the sense that violence against women is acceptable. It's still not necessarily seen as a crime. And there was this same law that made rape a crime just a year ago, also strengthened the law around violence against women. But it's still very unusual for people to go to court and win prosecutions in cases of violence against women. I mean, actually, one of the signs of progress is that we've seen in the last year or so, or 18 months, we've seen a couple of incredibly brave women who I think have just decided that they have nothing else to lose, who have been raped. We've seen them actually do interviews on television, which is new. I mean, this is quite a profound shift in society for a woman to face the kind of social, to break down that, try and break down that taboo about rape and actually talk about it for the first time. So this is in flux, which I find encouraging, but for the vast mass of women who suffer these abuses, they suffer in absolute silence.
We've got more troops in Afghanistan. We've done a build-up there. Have you seen an impact on your work one way or the other from that?
I mean, the troops are not there to protect women's rights. I think there are many other things that the U.S. is doing that are, you know, designed to protect women's rights. And I think in terms of U.S. policy in Afghanistan, probably the most important decisions I'll make in the coming months and years is how they try and encourage some kind of political settlement to the conflict, which doesn't mean women's rights are traded away, which doesn't mean, you know, areas of the country are effectively given up to the Taliban, or the constitution is open to please the Taliban, which may end up taking away women's rights, and doesn't mean that Taliban commanders with a track record in attacking women or attacking girls' schools are then suddenly made, you know, the district governor. So we're also calling for vetting of whoever is reintegrated or reconciled with. So it's these kinds of issues that I'm looking at in terms of trying to protect women's rights going forward, rather than assuming that troop presence is either good or bad for women's rights. It's not as black and white to me in that sense.
Rachel Reed is with Human Rights Watch. To find out more, go to hrw.org. Coming up, living beyond your means can sneak up on you. Our personal finance expert has the warning signs. And we'll profile an actor whose creativity and passion for progressive causes work side by side. If you missed part of our show, you can find us online at WAMC.org or call 1-800-323-9262 to order a CD. This week's show is number 1118. As the experts tell us the economy is recovering, many of us are cautiously loosening our stranglehold on our wallets, particularly at this time of year. And that may be a good thing in moderation. But personal finance expert Manisha Thakur says if you're shopping all year long, you may be a victim of an insidious intruder.
Have you ever felt like your possessions are holding you hostage? Or perhaps that you've bit off more stuff than you can chew? If you feel like you've got financial indigestion, you may be one of the millions of Americans suffering from lifestyle creep. Today I'm going to give you 5 signs that you might be suffering from lifestyle creep. But first, let me define what lifestyle creep, or what some people call lifestyle inflation, actually is. It's not to be confused with merely keeping up with the Joneses. Lifestyle creep occurs when the more you have, the more you think you need. Here's an example. You get a new pair of pants, but they don't go with your old shoes, so you have to get some new shoes. Then you look pretty spiffy, but you feel like you need a fresh top. Now in this dandy outfit, however, you no longer look as good in your car as you used to, so, well, you get the point. Here are 5 signs that this might be happening to you. Number 1, you have a public storage unit. If so, you're not alone. An amazing 1 in 10 Americans have them. As of year-end 2009, there was 2.4 billion square feet of public storage space in the U.S. To put this in perspective, if you lump them all together, they would be 3 times the size of Manhattan Island under one roof. I mean, really, that's a lot of stuff in storage. If you're running around with the key to a storage unit, it could well be a sign that your lifestyle is quite literally bulging at the seams of your home. My friend Francine Jay, author of Frugalionaire, first brought this to my attention, and it is so very true. Number 2. Your house has more toilets or TVs than occupants. You know, my grandmother's house had one toilet and one TV for four people. There was no loss of life or limb. Think about your average home right now. How many toilets do you have? How many people are living in your home? Or do it with TVs. The point is, what we Americans think we need has gotten terribly confused with what we want. Number three, your clothes and accessories are covered in logos. There's a classic scene in the movie Sex and the City where Carrie's assistant, played by Jennifer Hudson, wants to carry a four-digit designer bag so badly she rents one. With all due respect, if you are working hard as an assistant, you deserve some pleasure. But a $2,000 handbag is crazy. Yet that's what happened. As my dear friend and author Shira Baugh says, we've moved from keeping up with the Joneses to keeping up with the Catherine Zeta-Joneses. Number four, you frequently return home with a new item, only to find out you already have it. Elaine St. James, author of Simplify Your Life, coined the term the nail file theory. If you have just one nail file, the theory says, you always know where it is. But once you have two nail files, you can never find one. If you find you're out and about and are arriving home with a CD, pair of shoes, or sporting equipment, only to find out that you already had it tucked away somewhere, that could likely be a sign of the creep. Last but not least, you visit the mall more often than you do the grocery store. One in three Americans are obese, physically. As a nation, we do not eat nearly enough fresh veggies and fruits. I'm of Indian heritage, and growing up, we visited my family in India frequently. Going to the local vegetable market for fresh fruits and vegetables was a near daily ritual. Today, most of us shop at the mall more often than we shop at the grocery store, and as a result, we've become financially obese as well. So how can you prevent lifestyle creep? Here are three simple suggestions. First, spend time around like-minded people who are looking to spend their money more mindfully. Next, buy few, but buy the best you can afford in cash at the time so you really savor and enjoy those items. Last but not least, remember that experiences often bring more lasting pleasure than any material possession ever will. For 51%, I'm Manisha Thakur.
Manisha Thakur is the founder of the Women's Financial Literacy Initiative. You can find out more at manishathakur.com. And finally, Academy Award winner Susan Sarandon plays two very different roles, actress and activist. Yet, she says they share the common trait of imagination. She's able to imagine herself in someone else's shoes and then wants to help them. Nancy Greenlease reports from Italy with this profile.
Susan Sarandon, the activist, arrived on center stage before the actress. She was studying drama at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C.
You know, I just came of age at a time when if you had any brain at all in the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, you know, we stopped a war. You had sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but you also were in the street and it made a difference. And I have no idea. There's no one else in my family that has this problem. I'm the only one.
The eldest of nine children grew up in Edison, New Jersey. Her father was a former big band singer who barred Sarandon from singing at home. He said her voice was terrible. Yet in 1975, in one of her first big roles, Sarandon acted and sang as Janet, a good girl gone bad in the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I've got an itch to scratch. I need assistance. Touch, 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 touch me. I want to be dirty.
Sarandon went from cult film to art house favorite. Louis Malle's Atlantic City in 1980 earned her an Academy Award nomination. In the mid-1980s, she had her first of three children, a daughter with an Italian director. Living in Rome, she flew back to the U.S. to fight for a role. Associate Professor Paul Zinder, who teaches film courses at the American University of Rome, says this part catapulted her into the big leagues.
If you're to look at Sarandon's kind of coming out party, it was Bull Durham in 1988.
Sarandon plays an English teacher and baseball groupie who selects a minor league player each year to seduce and teach about poetry, baseball, and life. Her former partner, Tim Robbins, played the dim-witted pitcher.
What's that?
That's my leg.
I know what it is.
I just thought maybe we could work on some fundamentals since we're not going to make love and kind of improve your hand-eye coordination.
My hand-eye coordination?
Mm-hmm. Unsnap my stocking.
What was unique about Sarandon's role in that film is that she is, first of all, non-conventional looking for a Hollywood, sex goddess, so to speak. However, her confidence was quite clear to everyone who watched the film, and really her comedic gifts as well related directly to her sexual confidence.
Hollywood directors noticed, putting her among the A-list actresses. Sarandon realized her fame could serve another function.
After I became a celebrity, it just seemed to make so much sense to be able to use my celebrity to get press to go somewhere where they weren't going, to cover the early days of AIDS, for instance, or sex trafficking.
Sarandon fought for gay rights when it was still a taboo subject and has worked behind the scenes for years for MADRE, an international women's rights group. Ending poverty and social justice causes are also important to her. The staunch liberal who opposes the death penalty saw her art and activism mesh completely in the 1995 film Dead Man Walking. She won an Academy Award for her portrayal of a nun who counsels a death row inmate. This fall, she took on a new challenge from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. Director General Jacques Diouf invited her to help feed the world's 1 billion hungry people.
It is with profound emotion and pride that I nominate Mrs. Sarandon FAO Goodwill Ambassador.
Sarandon addressed the gathered diplomats and aid workers from every corner of the globe. Her knowledge of the issues rivals the experts, yet she also brings humanity to her mission.
As a mother, I can't imagine anything more upsetting, demoralizing, frustrating than not being able to feed your child. And so I'm accepting this award as a call to action.
The U.S. ambassador to Rome's aid agencies, Eartha Wrynn Cousin, met Sarandon and recognized immediately that she brings more than her stardom to the mission.
Underneath all of those characters that I've so enjoyed watching in the movies is a real person who cares.
Sarandon shows no signs of slowing down her activism or her art now that she's eligible for Social Security. Paul Zinder says she's bucking the trend of many older actresses who disappear from the screen or try to stay young through plastic surgery.
She is not someone who fears aging. In fact, I think she has ignored her age and just taken the role that she felt like taking, throughout her career.
Sarandon has found meaty parts in independent films and television. It's the 1960s rebel in her, always seeking meaning in her life and work. For 51%, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Rome.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton and Glenn Busby for production assistance. Our music is by Kevin Bartlett. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Click the link to programming and look for 51% under National Productions. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51% The Women's Perspective.